Ok. O mekanı temizlemesi yanlış bir şeyler kayacak şöyle bir. So thank all of you for coming here today evening, and I'll be speaking as the title suggests, the topic of spirituality in the age of science. This is a very big topic, and I'll be focusing within this on a topic which is not so philosophical, but is more practical, of something of immediate and empowering relevance for ourselves. That is the topic of managing the messy mind. Once, a group of 10 friends came to a metropolitan city for an outing, and they got a room on the 100th floor of a hotel, a skyscraper hotel. They went by an elevator, kept their luggage, freshened themselves, and then went out to see the sights in the city. When they came back, they found, to their dismay, that the power had gone off. That meant they now had to climb up 100 floors. So one of them got an idea. He said, let us entertain each other by telling stories. And each of us can tell a story that lasts for about 10 floors, 10 levels. Then we can reach the 100th level like that. So they all agreed. They started telling the stories. And some of them told slightly longer stories. So by the time the turn of the last person came, they had already come to the 95th floor. They said, now tell your story. He said, no, I can't tell my story. It's a tragedy. No, tell it, come on. We all told the story. Now if I tell the story, it'll shatter your hearts. No, please tell it. No, I cannot bear to shatter your hearts. As they were talking like this, they're climbing up. Everyone was pushing him to tell the story. He was saying no. Finally, they came 98, 99, 100th floor they came. When they came in front of their door, he said, I have to tell you the story now. I have forgotten the key downstairs. So, actually, in the last 5 centuries especially, science has made tremendous advancement. We have climbed up the tower of knowledge. And the kind of technology that we have today, say by just pressing a few buttons, you can talk with anyone in any part of the world, that would have been unimaginable, not just 500 years ago, even 50 years ago. So science has made stupendous advancement. At the same time, something seems to be missing. As Martin Luther King has said, our scientific power has outrun our spiritual power. We have guided missiles and misguided men. We have phenomenal power to guide the world outside us. But inside us, there's a turbulence of thoughts, emotions, desires, doubts, fears. And they make us act in ways that harm ourselves and harm others. So the key is the art of becoming happy. We all want to be happy in life. We all want to become better human beings. We want to contribute better, do better justice to our talents, and eventually become happy. But despite the scientific progress, somehow people are not happier. Next. So the mind is a mess. The WHO said that for the current century, if not the current millennia, the biggest health problem is going to be mental health. And when you talk about mental health, it is not just anxiety and some other disorders which we are talking about. Yes, they are in anxiety-related disorders, depression, and then from the mind behavior-related problems to the addictions. All these are in phenomenal and alarming numbers. But, so the mind is attacking the body in the sense that psychosomatic problems are a big, big health hazard today. And it is not just in terms of the mind inducing certain diseases in the body, but literally also people with disturbed minds often end up getting so frustrated did they contemplate suicide? They may even commit suicide. So according to WHO, 1 million people commit suicide every year. This figure of 1 million is actually, it implies one suicide every 40 seconds. That means since I started this talk, almost 15 people have committed suicide. This figure is actually more than the number of people who are killed in wars, murders, terrorist attacks, all combined together. That means more than the number of people who are being killed by others are the people who are killing themselves. So, why do people end their lives? Suicide is, of course, a very complex issue. But underlying it is all is an inability to deal with life's issues. And that is actually often the result of the mind magnifying the problems that we are facing. So when we imagine the problems to be bigger and bigger and bigger and we feel that I'm small, I can't deal with this problem, we get crushed. Go ahead. Yeah. Now there is, of course, through science we have medicine for the mind, but mental medicine is often a bigger mess. There are books written not by some conspiracy theorists, but by insiders in the field of science. These are two books written by psychiatrists and scientists themselves. One is Cracked, Why Psychiatry is Doing More Harm Than Good. It's by James Davies. And the other is The Age of Anxiety, A History of America's Turbulent Affair with Tranquilizers. That's by Andrea Tone. Now, these books document, these are just two books, there are several books like this, which document how people with mental health problems, they go to psychiatrists and they take treatments. And quite often, the treatments, instead of curing their disease or curing their problem, it ends up perpetuating their problem. Now, why is that? Now, I'm not here criticizing psychiatry per se. Now, there are psychiatrists who are very diligent, dedicated, hard workers who try to understand, map the human brain, and try to treat patients to the best of their capacities. But there is a fundamental problem in dealing with the inner world. Can you go ahead? That problem is that when we pathologize human problems, by pathologizing human problems, we perpetuate them. Human problems means all of us in our life journey, we face loss. We face failure, we face rejection, we face reversals of various kinds. And this is just a part of being human. And there are mature human responses to such problems, and there are immature responses. See, life determines our problems. Our mind determines their size. Life determines our problems. Our mind determines the size of those problems. That means, say if we go for a party or if we come to class and then we see an acquaintance and we smile and greet that acquaintance and that person just snubs us. Now that snub happens in maybe 10 seconds, but then for the next several hours we may be seething with anger. How dare they do this to me? And, you know, we'll be sitting in a class. Why? But we are not hearing one word of what is being spoken in the class. Our mind is on a dance of revenge fantasies. Yeah, I'm going to snub them. And I'll snub them in public in such a way that I'll take revenge. Now, that moment just passed in a, that problem just passed in a few moments. But the more we dwell on it, the bigger the problem seems to become. And that person just going on with their life. They may not even have intentionally snubbed us. They might have just not noticed us. Or even if they have, they are going on with their life and we are reducing ourselves to a seething mass of nerves. So many times if we see the problem, say, is like if somebody is a porter and the porter has to carry 10 kg weight. That's difficult, but it's manageable. But if the porter instead starts carrying a 40 kg weight, it becomes much more difficult. So the problems we face in life are like a 10 kg weight. But our reaction to those problems, when we resent those problems, when we rage over those problems, they are like an addition of a 30 kg weight on it. And then we make the problem, our mind makes the problem bigger than what it needs to be. And thus, the mental health becomes deteriorated. So now, what happens in psychiatry is, there's a well-known experiment done in, a case study done, it was in England. There's one per person who was told to go to six different psychiatrists. And he was told to describe certain symptoms. You know, I have anxiety, I have negativity, I have fear. So he described a set of symptoms. And this is well documented in psychiatry. What happened was six different psychiatrists gave six different diagnoses. The same symptoms, six substantially different diagnoses. Each of them, they say, okay, this is your problem, this is your problem, this is your problem. And based on six different diagnoses, they proposed six different prescriptions. And actually, none of them helped the patient. So now, why did this happen? Because when we come to the inner world, things are not tangible. See, if somebody has got malaria, somebody has got pneumonia, somebody has got tuberculosis, then new things can be seen under a microscope. Okay, this is a germ over here. This is the infecting agent, and this is the medicine that can cure this infection. But when it comes to the inner world, there are simply symptoms, and there is no biological, tangible, isolable cause that can be isolated, examined in a microscope, and treated. And that is why analyzing and treating mental health problems often becomes an exercise in guesswork. So, okay, you have this symptom, this symptom, this symptom. And if people have these symptoms, it can be this disease. If people have this symptom, it can be this disease. So whichever symptoms the doctor, the particular doctor who's analyzing, he or she highlights, they give a particular inference based on that. And unfortunately, not only is the analyzing of mental health based to a large extent on guesswork, along with that, there is also the whole big money that is funding the pharma industry. So, since before 1950s, medicines for mental health were practically unknown. If you go to a doctor, you got a wound, some fracture, some disease in the body. The mental health, it was just thought that you deal with it by coping with life, by learning to cope with life. Now, here again, I'm not minimizing the importance of psychiatry or medicines. See, if there are sometimes structural problems, some people have brain damage, or there are chemical problems where a particular hormone or a particular chemical is less in the brain. And these are again, as I said, measurable, tangible problems. But when the problems have no structural or chemical cause, and the problems are primarily behavioral, people feel very fearful, people feel very, very short-tempered, or whatever. For such kind of things where the problem is primarily behavioral without any biological basis to a very biological cause of the problem, then the treatment, the analysis, the diagnosis becomes very speculative, the treatment also becomes very speculative. And because there is big money in the pharma industry, especially for treating mental health, then quite often the treatment is perpetuated longer and longer. And in fact, some of the companies which treat mental health, you know, their budgets or their turnovers are bigger than the national budgets of several countries. So when money and medicine are brought together in a field where things are not tangible, then it is a very, very messy situation that comes up. So now, when there are human problems, we need spiritual solutions more than biological solutions, more than chemical solutions. Now, chemical solutions, as I said, they can be needed in certain situations. But we need to grow internally to deal with human problems. And that inner growth happens when we understand our spiritual side. Go ahead. So now, is this idea of we having a spiritual side, is this for real? Or is it just some people's imagination that we have a spiritual side? No, we have to understand that science works in a particular way. Science looks for matter, not for spirit. That means science works by looking for material explanations for material phenomena. So Newton saw a fruit falling. What could be the cause of this? He came up with the theory of gravity. And this method works very good, very effectively when material factors are all that is involved. But if there is a non-material factor involved, science cannot detect it. Just as if I go for fishing and I have a fishing net which has a hole of 1 inch by 1 inch. Then no matter how long I cast the fishing net, any fish that are smaller than 1 inch in their size, I will never be able to catch them. They'll just slip out of the holes. Similarly, science casts a net at the world to catch knowledge about the world. But because its net is material, it looks for material factors. And when any non-material factor is involved, it slips out. This is not a limitation of science. This is not a criticism of science. Every method has its focus. And when it has its focus, it has its scope. So when I focus on something, if I'm looking at you, now I cannot be looking here or looking there. So there's a focus. And science is very powerful where it focuses. But its very focus also limits its scope. Just as I can use an X-ray to understand the health of a person. But no matter how scientifically advanced our X-ray machines or CT scan machines will become, now they cannot tell us the personality of the person. Now, what is the nature of the person? What are they like? Are they introverts? Are they extroverts? Are they sociable? What are they? We can't tell that. You know, if say we want to form a relationship with someone, now, we are not going to say, let me see your X-ray before I decide to form a relationship or not. Now, we need to know something different, and this is a different thing for that purpose. So, or just as no matter how sophisticated a camera I have, if the camera is black and white, I can't see a color image. So now, when we come to our inner world, there are emotions, there are thoughts, there are desires. All of these are real for us. But they are not observable in their originality. You know, how can I observe a thought? How can I observe an emotion? Now, when scientists, when researchers, now they know that if a person is dreaming, if we keep probes on the brain, we can find out based on the kind of waves that are formed in the brain or the kind of movement that is there of the eyes, call it rapid eye movement. If that is happening, then we can know that the person is dreaming. But no matter how advanced the probes become, we cannot know what the person is dreaming. By knowing how the brain is being activated, I can know, okay, the person is dreaming. But if I want to know what the person is dreaming, I have to wake them up and ask them, what were you dreaming? So there is a irreducibility to the experiences that we have. And they cannot be analyzed in material terms. So what is the locus of our experiences? Who is it that is experiencing? That something, you and I, we are actually at our core non-material. So now, science cannot prove this, but science can point to this. So I'll talk about one experiment here which points to this. Go ahead. So this Dr. Wilder Penfield is considered the father of neurosurgery. He's a Nobel laureate, and he wrote a book, The Mystery of the Mind. And what he did in this book is, he did many experiments for nearly 4 decades. And one of the experiments, which was very significant, was that he had a subject whose brain he activated through electrodes. Now, it is well known that certain areas of the brain are connected with certain bodily functions. So, for example, the frontal lobe of the brain is connected with motor nervous function. So, he activated the frontal lobe. He asked the subject, raise your hand. When he raised his hand, what happened? He said, I raised my hand. Put your hand down. Put his hand down. What happened? I put my hand down. Then afterwards, he used the electrodes, the probe, to activate that part of the brain. And then, what happened? He said, my hand went up. Did you raise your hand? No, I didn't. You did. Then he deactivated the probe. The hand fell down. What happened? He said, my hand fell down. Did you put your hand down? No, I didn't. You did. Now, to understand the implication of this experiment, consider, say, a computer and a printer. If I have a printer next to a computer and there's a print button. When I press the print button, the printer hand of the computer moves. Now, it's my computer. I can press the print button. Or while I'm observing, you can come there and you can press the print button. When you press the print button, either way, whoever presses the print button, the printer hand of the computer will move. So analogously, the area of the brain which controls motor nervous function, that is like the print button. The print button is pressed, the hand moves up or hand moves down. Now, in the second case, it was Dr. Penfield who pressed the print button, who activated that part of the brain. In the first case, who activated it? So Dr. Penfield tried to activate while repeating the same experiment. He activated different parts of the brain. And when different parts of the brain were activated, different things happened in the body. But no area of the brain when activated ever gave the person the feeling that I am doing the action, that I am raising the hand. The subject was simply observing, not doing. So based on this, Dr. Penfield concluded that the source of consciousness is extracerebral. So consciousness originates in some source outside the brain. And understanding this is vital for managing the mind. So ultimately, you know, we are human beings. We are on a human journey. We are neither scientists nor are we spiritualists. We are human beings, and whatever helps us to move forward on our human journey, we can be open to those sources of knowledge and empower ourselves. So science offers us knowledge and spirituality offers us knowledge. So science can help us make things better. Outside things, we can improve them phenomenally. Spirituality can offer us insights which can make our inner world better. Let's move ahead. So, the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita, is an ancient yoga text from India, and it offers a tripartite, three-level model of the self. Now, who are we? If this question is asked, then there is a three-level answer to it. Now, we have the body, the mind, and the soul. All these three comprise our present being. And to understand this, the body is like the hardware of a computer. The mind is like the software. And the soul is like the user. Now, if my computer is not functioning, one possibility is that some hardware part is damaged. And then I have to repair the hardware. Another possibility could be that some software is damaged. Maybe some software is corrupted. Maybe some virus has infected the software. Then, at that time, I need the appropriate process. If I start tinkering with the hardware, no matter how expensive and how extensive the changes I make in the hardware, they are not going to make my computer function again. Because the problem is not in the hardware. The problem is in the software. So similarly, when there are mental health issues, if we try to treat them simply by biological means, simply by using some tranquilizers, some drugs, then that is like trying to repair the hardware when the problem is in the software. No matter how much we change, how much change the hardware, the computer is not going to function. Similarly, no matter how much chemicals we pump into the body, we may temporarily feel good, but actually we won't become better. So why would we temporarily, now when we take tranquilizers, when we take mental health medicines, we do feel better. Now how is that we feel better? That is simply a physical reaction to a physical stimulus. And I come from India. So in India, when relatives come to meet a family and they have a small child, then what happens? The relatives, just to have some fun with the child, they may tickle the child. They tickle the belly of the child. And when the child is tickled, the child starts laughing. So now, when the child starts laughing, is that laughter happiness? Is that laughter happiness? What do you think? Yeah, it's laughing, but if that were happiness, and we all want to be happy in life, then all of us could get our own perpetual tickling machines. Isn't it? Whenever we want to be happy, activate the machine and we'll be happy. No, that laughter is not happiness. It is the biological reaction to a biological stimuli. But that is not happiness. Happiness is something internal which may express itself as laughter. You know, if somebody just comes along and twists our face so that there's a smile on our face. You know, that is not happiness. So like that, sometimes some chemicals may be inserted into the body, and some researchers may find that, okay, when a person is happy, these chemicals are more in the brain. And when they are unhappy, these chemicals are more. So if you want to remove depression, okay, decrease that chemical and increase this chemical. So we may take some medicines by which we decrease this chemical, which is supposed to be associated with unhappiness, and increase the chemicals you're supposed to be associated with happiness. Now, will that make a person happy? Actually, the chemical composition of the brain is not the cause of emotions. It is the result of emotions. Just like laughter is not the cause of happiness. Laughter is the result of happiness. When I am happy, I naturally laugh. Now, if someone physically, we make a machine which makes me move my jaws in such a way that I'm laughing, that's not happiness. So we cannot if we mistake the cause and effect, then we perpetuate our misconceptions. So what happens with tranquilizers and other mental health drugs is that they try to change the chemical composition of the brain, and they think that by that people will become happy. Temporarily we feel good. It's like if a child is glum and somebody comes and tickles, the child may laugh. And they may temporarily feel good. But that's not the solution. And actually, the child has to be loved, cared, and whatever needs to be done so that they become happy. So happiness comes from something much inner, at our core of our being. So when negative thoughts, worries, or pessimism, all these, they infect the software of the mind. When the software is infected, then at that time, we need to develop healthy thought patterns. It is not just a matter of taking some chemicals. And that is where life's spiritual dimension comes into picture. So please move ahead. This is a little intricate slide. See, spirituality is also a higher dimensional science. Just as in science, there is theory and experiment. So Newton observed the fruit falling. Based on his thought, why did this fruit fall? He came up with theory of gravity. And then he did experiments. Okay, not just a fruit, a stone, any object, and not just here in different parts of the world. It will fall. So the experiment verifies the theory or disproves the theory. Similarly, spirituality has two limbs. There is philosophy and there is religion. So philosophy gives us postulates that about the nature of the spiritual side of life. Okay, what is there? So for example, the Bhagavad Gita is a philosophical book. And it tells us, this yoga text tells us that actually, I talked about this three-level model of the self. That is the philosophy. So that is like a theory. Now how do I know whether it is right or wrong? That is by doing some practices. And religion is not meant to be just a set of rituals, although quite often it is like that. It is meant to be a set of practices that enable us to either verify or disprove the postulates that are given in the philosophy. Now, unfortunately, when spirituality is not approached in an integrated way like this, both philosophy and religion coming together, then it can have counterproductive consequences. Go ahead, full. So, Srila Prabhupada, he was a great modern-day yoga exponent, bhakti yoga exponent, and he explained the relationship between philosophy and religion. Go ahead. Yeah. So if we have only philosophy and no religion, philosophy and religion is just mental speculation. That is, maybe it's like this, maybe it's like that, maybe that is how it is, maybe that is how it is. So different people can come up with their own different ideas of what things are. But how does anyone know what it is? It's all just in the head. And there is no way to transform ourselves to realize anything higher. That's happened when philosophy is divorced from religion. Go ahead, full. On the other hand, if religion is divorced from philosophy, that means there's only religion and there's no philosophy, then that is at best sentimentalism and at worst fanaticism. So today we see fanaticism in some religions, and that is because the religion, the practices are divorced from a proper philosophy. So then the idea becomes my way is the only way. And everyone who is not following is my way, they are going to go to hell. And some fanatics say, not only are you going to go to hell, we will help you get there faster. So, that idea comes up, and that leads to intolerance, that leads to violence, that leads to terrorism. So now this is because of a misapplication of the spiritual path. So the spiritual wisdom, when both of them are brought together, when there's philosophy and religion, then there is proper understanding of life's higher dimension, and there are practices by which one can realize the higher dimensions of life. So I'll talk about one aspect of realizing these higher dimensions. Move ahead. Yeah. So spirituality is a higher dimensional science. That means it is not experimental, it is experiential. Now the thing which we want to experiment is not out there, it is in here. So if I want to study a bacteria or study a microbe, I can put it under a microscope. But here we want to experiment with our own consciousness. And that's why it's not just experiment, it's an experience. So material science is experimental, spiritual science is experiential. So science often operates with controlled experiments. Okay, I want to observe the behavior of this chemical, then put it in a controlled environment where no other chemicals are going to affect it, and then observe its changes. So we do controlled experiments. So similarly, when you come to spirituality, we need to control, but that control is of our inner world. That is, we experience through self-control. We subject our consciousness to certain stimuli and avoid other stimuli. And thereby, we open ourselves to higher dimensions of reality. Move ahead. So one aspect of this is, one aspect of spirituality is a higher dimensional science is mantra yoga. Mantra refers to spiritual sound. Sound that has spiritual power within it. So these mantras, there are many different mantras which are chanted in different traditions. And the idea of mantra is etymologically manastrayate iti mantra. That sound which has the power to free the mind from its negativities, from its misgivings. So going back to the software analogy, the mind is like the software. And mantra is like the antivirus software. So when we expose our consciousness to mantras, when we chant mantras, the negativities in the mind get cleansed. And that's how we become more positive, more focused, more productive. We'll talk about two aspects of this, how the mantra works. Mantra acts as an elevator of consciousness. I told earlier that our existence is three levels. There is body, mind and soul. So now at the level of the soul, there is natural joyfulness. Because the soul by nature is joyful. In fact, because our souls are joyful, that's why we are always joy seeking. That's why we always look for pleasure. So that pleasure is found at the spiritual level. So we could consider this as a multi-story building. It's the body, the mind and the soul. All three are aspects of our being. But presently, our consciousness is caught at the material level. So when we chant spiritual sounds, so for example, we chant the mantra Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. So this mantra acts as an elevator of our consciousness. So when we are at the material level of consciousness, this mantra, if we focus on it, if we concentrate on it, then it is like entering into an elevator. And then our consciousness rises upwards. And then as our consciousness comes to the spiritual level, we experience natural peacefulness and joyfulness. Prashanta manasam hyenam yoginam sukham uttamam upaiti shantarajasam brahmabhutam akalmasham. In the Bhagavad Gita, in the 6th chapter, 27th text, it is described that as our consciousness rises to the spiritual level, shanta, we become peaceful. Sukham, we become joyful. This is an elevator of consciousness. It's like, say, if we are in a building where there's flooding, at the ground floor there's flooding, but the water has not reached the second floor. Then I just take an elevator and go up, then I become safe. I become free from the threat of being flooded by the water. So like that, at the material level, there is anxiety. There is negativity, there is uncertainty. But as soon as we rise to the spiritual level of consciousness, we become peaceful. And secondly, mantra acts like an inner muscle builder. Now we all we may be doing workouts to improve our health, to improve our muscles. So when we chant the mantra, at that time, that is like an inner workout. What this inner workout does is, it makes us more powerful in choosing the kind of thoughts we want to focus and rejecting other thoughts. So in our mind, there are many thoughts going on. I'll conclude with this example that, say, suppose we are browsing a particular page on our device, maybe phone or computer. And say there is one article which we are reading, and there are many other links over there. So now while reading that, our eyes may go to some other link. Okay, this link, this article seems interesting. I click on it, and then we go over there. And then we sometimes, especially, we may start seeing some videos or watching some images. And sometimes people spend hours and hours. And after all, hey, why did I waste so much time? So surfing on the net becomes suffering on the net. So we waste so much time. Now imagine if in future there were a device so sophisticated that if you're reading an article and if you just look at the link, that link would pop up. We don't have to click on it, we just look at the link and that link expands, pops up. Now we would be lost, you know, just looking at the link, and we'll go from one side to another side to another side, one page to another page. So our mind is actually like that. Right now, say you are focusing, say you are trying to hear what I'm saying. I am trying to focus on what you are saying. Now suddenly this clapping has started. That's like another link that has come. So now if you focus on that, what could the clapping be? Oh, maybe there's a birthday party going on. Whose birthday might it be? Is there a cake over there? So like that, you know, while the mind has multiple clickable links in it constantly. And whichever you focus on, that pops up and that grows. And if our inner muscles are not strong, then whichever link is seen, we just choose that and we get caught. We get caught and we get distracted. And when we get distracted, we cannot be productive. We sit down to study. 1 hour, we are in our library, but our mind has gone on a tour of the universe. We are not able to focus. If we could focus, we could become so much more productive. So when we chant the mantra, then this mantra chanting becomes like an inner muscle builder. Because when you focus on the mantra, the mind goes away focused. Mind goes away focused. By that, our capacity to concentrate increases. And that capacity to concentrate is our inner muscle. So we can choose what we want to focus on. And thus, earlier I said about how when the mind dwells on problems, it makes problems bigger and bigger. But when our inner muscles are strong, okay, there is a problem, but I don't have to think about the problem constantly. I can think about more constructive things. I can think maybe of solution of the problem, or I can just leave the problem and think of other things. Later on, when I am calmer, I'll come back and think about how to deal with the problem. So if our inner muscles are stronger, then whatever we are doing, we'll be able to focus on better. And when problems come in life, we won't let those problems grow bigger. And that way, we will become more productive and effective in our lives. And this inner change is what spirituality can offer us, this inner empowerment, by which whatever abilities we have, you know, we will be able to tap them better. So spirituality increases our ability to tap our ability. We have certain abilities, but if our mind is distracted, we can't tap those abilities. But when we become spiritual, it increases our ability to tap our ability. And thus, we can become better achievers, we can become more constructive and more successful in our lives. So I'll summarize. I started by talking about how do we need spirituality in the age of science. We talked about science has phenomenally transformed the world around us. And science has made things better. But we need spirituality to make people better, to make ourselves better. Discuss how, despite the enormous advancements of science, you know, as Martin Luther King said, that we have guided missiles and misguided men. I discuss the story of how people climbed up 100 stories, but they forgot to carry the key of the room. So like that, science has ascended enormously in knowledge, but the key of becoming happy in life, that has been forgotten. And that requires managing our inner world. And in the inner world, we discuss how the mind is a mess. The mental health problems are the biggest health challenge in today's world, and the mind is attacking the body, not just through psychosomatic diseases, but even through suicidal urges. More than the number of people who are being killed by others are the people who are killing themselves. 1 million people commit suicide every year. And when science tries to deal with mental health issues, often that creates bigger problems. We discuss about how pathologizing human problems ends up perpetuating them. Because if the problem is structural or there is a clear chemical deficiency which is causing a problem, then certainly psychiatric treatment is fine. But if there are behavioral problems, then trying to use psychiatry to treat that is like trying to cure a software problem by changing the hardware. It just doesn't work. We discussed how the Gita offers a three-level model of the self. The body is like the hardware, the mind is like the software, and the soul, the essence of who we are, is like the user. We discussed Dr. Penfield's experiment about raising hands, based on which he concluded that the source of consciousness is extracerebral. And then I talked about how spirituality is a higher dimensional science. Just as in science there are experiments to verify a theory or to disprove the theory, similarly in philosophy, in spirituality there are practices which can verify what the philosophy is teaching us. So science has two limbs, theory and experiment. So spirituality has two limbs, philosophy and religion. And if there is philosophy without religion, that is mental speculation. If there is religion without philosophy, that is sentimentalism or fanaticism. When both are balanced together, then spirituality becomes a potent form of inner empowerment and inner transformation. And in that connection, I discussed about spirituality is an experiential science, not an experiment science, not an experimental science. And for experiencing, rather than controlling the environment around us, we need to control the environment within us. And a key aspect of controlling the environment within us is practice of mantra yoga, wherein we expose our consciousness to spiritual sound. And this exposure to spiritual sound, what does it do? It elevates our consciousness. It is like the antivirus software, which cleanses the software of the corruption in the software of the mind. And how does that cleansing happen? In two ways. One is, mantra acts like an elevator of consciousness, by which whatever negativity, anxiety, insecurity that is there at the material level, if our consciousness rises to the spiritual level, we don't feel that. It's like if there's flooding at the ground floor, but if I go to a higher floor, I'm not troubled by the flooding. And secondly, mantra yoga acts like an inner muscle builder. So within our mind, there are many thoughts going on, and we need to focus on what is important. But like visually clickable links, whatever you focus on, those thoughts pop up and then we get distracted. So when we focus and concentrate on the mantras, that enhances our capacity to concentrate. And that increased capacity to concentrate is like our increased inner muscles. And they help us to focus and become productive in whatever we do. So our ability to tap our ability is enhanced by our spirituality. Thank you very much for your kind attention. Does anyone of you have any questions? Yes, please. Yeah.
Is there an added benefit of using mantra rather than just focusing on breathing?
Yeah, yes. See, mindfulness involving breath control is also very helpful, because our breathing is connected with the state of our mind. When we are agitated, we naturally breathe faster. So if we consciously try to slow down our breath, we can become calmer, we can become more focused. Now, when we do mindfulness, we depend primarily on our own power. It is our capacity to be mindful. Whereas when we chant mantras, the mantras invoke higher reality. So we are consciousness, we are tiny sparks of consciousness. And there is also the infinite consciousness. The infinite consciousness is infinitely powerful. So when we focus, we chant mantras, which link us with that higher consciousness, then the power of that infinite consciousness empowers us to overpower our mind's negativities. So we get higher assistance. Of course, we have to endeavor, whether it is in mindfulness or whether it is in chanting, we need to endeavor. But we get get help from higher powers. So I would say that mindfulness is like, mindfulness exercises, they also definitely help, but they are like climbing up the staircase. Whereas mantra chanting is like entering an elevator. So in elevator, there is power, other power, electric power, which lifts us up. So like that in mantra chanting, there is the power coming from the infinite consciousness that helps us in the elevation of our consciousness. The purpose of both is the same. Mantra yoga gives us access to higher power so that it becomes easier. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, please.
So you say that spirituality is experiential and science is experimental, but I feel like they're not, like, it's not like one can't exist with the other, and there are a lot of psychiatrists and psychologists that nowadays use mindfulness meditation,
yeah,
and they use yoga, and I feel like spirituality can be strengthened with science. Science is just taking a hypothesis, and spirituality seems to just be a pool of hypotheses that can be tested using science. I'm not saying that you shouldn't use spirituality until all the hypotheses are tested. I'm just saying that they can work coexist.
Yeah, of course. And as I said, that science is experimental, spirituality is experiential. Does that mean that science and spirituality can't coexist? Was that my implication? No, not at all. Certainly, science and spirituality can both reinforce each other, actually. The problem comes when the jurisdictions are not understood. And they say, good fences make good neighbors. You know, if there's, this is my, if you understand this, then there can be a cooperative living. So as I said, broadly speaking, science deals with the outer world. Science deals with the material world. Spirituality deals with the inner world. That is the spiritual side of our personality. But there are definitely areas where both of them intervene. And when we talk about science, it is not that scientists are necessarily materialists or anti-spiritualists. There can be many scientists who are also spiritually minded. And ultimately, many psychiatrists, psychologists, they are also intelligent, caring people who want to help. Now, if some of them, they stick to only one methodology for trying to help, then they may limit themselves. But those who are open, as I said, if they adopt meditational practices, they adopt mindfulness, then even for mantra chanting also, there has been research done in various universities. Studies have been done, and they found that mantra chanting helps people in becoming more positive in their attitudes. So that way, when I said that spirituality is experiential, in some ways, the experience can also be subjected to scientific scrutiny. But then we have what are called as hard sciences and soft sciences. Now, physics is considered a hard science, sociology, and even psychology to some extent is considered as soft science. So it is, in that sense, there is a slight difference between the two. But definitely, science and spirituality can coexist. In fact, they can not just coexist, they can complement each other. See, spirituality does not... So science, if it recognizes jurisdiction and gives spirituality its adequate, recognizes the role of spirituality, then from the science point of view, spirituality can coexist. When we talk about spirituality, the spiritual is never the replacement of the material. The spiritual is the complement of the material. That means, when we talk about being spiritual, even spiritualists have to eat. Spiritualists have to take care of the body. There's a saying in spiritual circles, your spirituality won't clean your teeth for you. Isn't it? So, if I wake up in the morning, it is not by chanting my mantras my teeth will become clean. No. There is a physical process required for that, and we do take the physical process. So, if some people do not have a proper understanding of spirituality, then they may position spirituality as contradictory to science. Science deals with material phenomena and how they interact. Spirituality deals with the spiritual side of our life. And it gives us a broader understanding by which we can use the material more effectively. So it is not that, say for example, the Bhagavad Gita is a yoga text where Arjuna is a warrior. And the speaker of the Gita, Krishna, doesn't tell Arjuna to renounce his duty as a warrior. Rather, the Gita gives Arjuna a spiritual direction for using his material expertise. So in that sense, spirituality doesn't reject the material, but rather it helps us to direct the material more productively. That's how both can coexist, definitely. Thank you. Yeah, any other questions? Yes, please.
So basically, epigenetics is like something about the genes. It's been showing to like play a key role in like pattern, like your personality kind of wise, so it affects your thought patterns, maybe spirituality, consciousness. Do you think that'll ever change what like spirituality will be? Because you can actually find happiness by changing yourself.
Okay. So genetics has been found to associate with personality and behavior. So can advancement in genetics replace spirituality, or it can provide happiness and it can play a spiritual role? See, genetics is a very remarkable body of knowledge that has been uncovered in the last century. And like any body of knowledge which newly comes up, you know, quite often there is the reality and there is the hype. So the reality of genetics is that, and now again this is a complex subject, I'll put it simply, the genes are like programs that determine the unfolding of bodily structure and behavior. Simple. So now this program, so for example, when we get certain genes from our parents when we are born, so those determine our pigment color, maybe our height, our bodily structure, various aspects of our bodily structure. But our personality, in terms of our core being, that transcends our genes. So there are twins. Now, twins have similar genes. And there are a kind of twins which are called as monozygotic twins. That means when one zygote is formed first, by the union of the sperm and the egg, and after that, that one zygote splits into two. Sometimes two sperms and eggs unite together, then the twins are formed. But sometimes one sperm and egg unite and a zygote is formed, but later during the gestation, that zygote splits into two. Now when this happens, the two twins that are result, they are called as monozygotic twins, coming from one zygote. And monozygotic twins, their genes are not just similar, they are identical, because they come from one zygote. And yet, monozygotic twins have distinct personalities. They are not, they may be physically identical, but they are psychologically, emotionally, they are distinct. Now, if our genes was determining everything about us, then monozygotic twins should be entirely identical. Not just physically, but even emotionally, psychologically entirely. It's not like that. So there is an aspect to our personality that goes beyond our genes. And the genes determine our physical structure, but at our core, we are spiritual beings. And as a spirituality and genetics, they deal with different areas of jurisdiction. Now, by changing genes, there can be certain aspects of our functions that can be changed. And that can happen even when, say, if a person gets brain damaged. Sometimes when brain surgery is done or brain damage happens, now people's personality changes. Now that does not mean necessarily that personality has originated from the brain. That is personality or consciousness that is transmitted through the brain. So one of the pioneers of psychology was William James. And he gave the example that the brain is like the prism for the light of consciousness. So now consciousness is a light that comes into the brain, and from that is transmitted out. If the prism gets broken, then the image that is formed from outside the prism, that will change. Why? Because the prism is a structure through which it is getting transmitted. Or for example, if I have a computer and say I do accounting, I do planning, I do writing, I do various functions of my computer. Say if the area of the computer, if my computer is divided into various drives, and the area where I have saved all my financial accounts, that gets deleted, then I can't perform the financial activities. I can't do them because that part has been deleted of the computer. But that does not mean that I have become depleted in any way. I am distinct. So like that genetic, just as the brain function, so change in damage to the brain structure or change in brain structure can affect people's behavior in some ways, because certain tools that they have for functioning, those tools get affected. Similarly, genetic change can limit or expand the tools available to us. And by that, to some extent, some aspects of behavior can be changed. But the personality itself, it comes from a non-material source. The genes, no matter how much detail we go to understand them, the genes are ultimately made of atoms and molecules. And atoms and molecules don't have consciousness. It is we are conscious beings. So in that sense, genes genes shape the structure of the body, and changing genes can change the tools available to the soul for functioning in the body. But the soul or the source of consciousness still remains different. Does that answer your question? You have something else you would like to ask?
No, you're good.
You didn't get it?
I got it.
Okay, fine, thank you. Yeah, fine. Any other questions?
I just want to clarify. Were you talking about epigenetics?
Yeah.
He was talking about epigenetics, which is, would you like to explain?
It's basically on the gene, when you're above the genes, it's like methylation, or like you're adding groups onto it, but it's not, and it's changeable throughout the lifetime.
I think in a simple language that if, for example, if I develop this spirituality, is there a possibility that this will transfer to my next generation? Or will they be influenced by this character?
Yeah.
What you get in this environment?
Epigenetics can affect offspring. It's about, largely about, so your DNA is, it's coiled around proteins.
Yeah.
Right? It's about how that DNA is coiled.
Yeah.
So if it's unspooled a little bit, it's like yarn, right? If you want to use the yarn, you have to unspool it so you can actually bend it in whatever way you want. Kind of like that. The parts that are tightly, tightly coiled around each other are hard to be used for insanity.
Okay. Yeah. See, specific developments in science, there are principles and there are specifics. When we come to specifics within science, there can be different branches of science. And I'm not a scientist. I have a science background in education, but I'm not a scientist, so I may not know the technicalities of what you're speaking. So I'll focus on principles. See, the body is a machine, like a hardware. And that hardware, okay, if we tinker with the hardware, then certain functionalities of the machine can be changed. The specifics of how we change the tinkering, that can vary depending on the sophistication of the approach that we have. So sometimes the idea that we can, that our genes determine us, this can be taken to alarming extremes. The whole project of eugenics, you may have heard of that in the history of science, that was what propelled Hitler's Nazi Germany. He had the idea that certain races are more fit than other races. And he said that, we Nazis are the fittest race and the Jews are the unfit race. So by evolution, the unfit will be removed. We will help evolution on the way. And we will remove the Jews. So that was called social Darwinism, which has later been disproved. But the idea that we are entirely functions of our genes, now that has been historically abused a lot. So certain races were deemed inferior, and there's rejection or exploitation or discrimination among those races that has happened also. So we have to be careful when genes and theories are associated, genes are extended beyond their specifics. Now, as far as our spirituality changing our personality and that passing on to the next generation, that's possible. Because spirituality, when we practice, that is, the spiritual affects the material. So there have been researchers which have determined that, you know, certain areas of the brain which are associated with deep thinking, they are activated when people meditate. And when they are activated, that means the synapses in the brain, they are better formed over there. And when the synapses are better formed, the person becomes more intellectually developed, the next generation may also pass it on. That's perfectly fine. We shouldn't just, the problem comes when we conflate or mistake the mechanism to be the person. The mechanism is not the person. The mechanism is the means for the person to function. And changing the mechanism doesn't change the person. It changes the tools available for the person to function. So, are there any questions or should we stop here?
If anybody else have any comments, I just wanted to one more question was, so is it should we as a human being, should we strive always to have, find a happy situation, or is it better to train our mind to be happy?
Okay, good question. Should we try to become happy, try to find happy situations, or should we just train ourselves to be happy in whatever situation we are? Actually, both are there. Both aspects are there. There are certain aspects of our life which are changeable. Certain aspects of our life which are not changeable. And we need to differentiate between the two. When you talk, just a couple of days ago, I gave a seminar on spirituality. Topic was that transform anxiety into intensity by spirituality. So actually, what I mean by that is, there are certain things in our life which are not in our control, certain things in our control. When we focus on the things not in our control, that causes anxiety. When we focus on the things that are in our control, that brings in intensity. Say a student is studying for the exam. At that time, if they worry, what will come in the exam? Will I be able to answer the questions? That causes anxiety. But they focus. Okay, now I have to study this. I have memorized this. Let me revise this so that it doesn't slip out of my mind. Tomorrow is the exam. Now this is the last time for me to revise what I have studied throughout my year. That will bring intensity. So focusing on what is in our control, that brings intensity. Obsessing over that which is not in our control causes anxiety. So in our life, there are certain things which we can't change. And resenting them only increases our misery. So learning to accept the reality as it is, that is foundational for becoming happy. If we are resenting reality, we can never be happy. So that's why training our mind to accept the unchangeable is an important component of finding happiness. But that does not mean that we become static and passive and I don't have initiative, don't take any initiative in life. There are areas in our life which we can change, where we can improve, we can become better, and we need to focus on that. So some of us may have talents in some fields, some of us may not have some talents in some fields. So if I just worry, I don't have talent in this field, I'll just become miserable. But if I find that I have talent in a particular field, then I work on that and improve that. Then by improving that, I'm able to perform better, I'm able to achieve better. That also will help me to become happy. So, you know, talent plus commitment leads to achievement. So whatever talents we have commitment to develop those talents. So talent plus commitment eventually leads to achievement. So like that, we also need to endeavor to do things which will bring value and happiness in our lives. So happiness has both those aspects, you know, accepting things which are unchangeable and focusing on things which are changeable. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Thank you. Yeah. You had a question? Sorry? Okay, fine. Any other questions?
Mrs. N here, let's give a big round of applause. Thank you very much. And as you said, there's these books are available, one about the mind and the different question and answers is up here. Captured. So let's go for a donation, $5. We're asking for simple books for printing. If you're interested, there's a person is manning the booth, Krishna. You can see him. And food is being served out. We can stand in the line. And there's a couple of announcements. Next week, from now onwards, there's no break. Every Monday, we're going to start again. We're going to send out the recipes. We're going to send out what we're going to make every week. So from now till Thanksgiving, hopefully.